It wasn't my case. I didn't have to deal with it.
So they piled them up and they burned down the house. I don't understand why you need a dive team.
Every dive environment has its own inherent dangers, and they have to be managed.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Hello and welcome to Best Case, Worst Case. This is Jim Clementi, former New York City prosecutor, retired FBI profiler, and writer-producer on TBS's Criminal Minds. And with me today remotely is...
Hi, everybody. It's Francie Hakes, former state and federal prosecutor. And I have to say, welcome back, Jim.
Absolutely. I'm so happy to be here because, as you know, this is an extremely special event.
It is.
This is our 100th episode of Best Case, Worst Case. And who would have thought? We have millions of downloads. We have so many topics that we've covered and so many amazing people we've interviewed, but probably none as fascinating and compelling as our very first live interview, Bobby Chacon. And with us today is...
Hi, everyone. I'm Bobby Chacon. I am a retired FBI agent and now contributor to XG Productions.
Yay! Awesome.
That's awesome.
But no, Jim, you're so right. This is so exciting to have Bobby here. It's our 100th episode. We started in June of 2017. And I just want to say thank you to all our listeners and everybody who writes in to us and lets us know that you're listening and asks questions and gives your comments. We really, really appreciate you.
We have come a long way since we interviewed you at CrimeCon 2017 in Indianapolis. It was a great event. It was actually a very moving story that you told. And we're hoping that maybe we can mine that brain of yours for another amazing story.
That's right. As everybody knows, Jim, Bobby is not just a pretty face in fins.
I don't think his face has ever been in fins, but maybe his feet have. I don't know.
I've seen it. Well, okay. In pictures.
You know, the topics that we've investigated and the cases that we've investigated are so horrific and so dark that it's really unusual. I just had a special air on Oxygen last week about the Israel Keyes case, which we've spoken about before. And I got a lot of feedback from that and people and saying, like, how do you deal with that? And how do you, you know, what was that like? And so, you know, it's a difficult thing to kind of put into words when people want to know about that particular case. But what that made me think is all the other cases I've worked. The first case on the dive team was, you know, a child killed by his own parents and thrown in the water. And we went and got him back. And, you know, we had so many cases of like that. It's, you know, it's what you do to adjust to that and to, I hate to say, to incorporate that into your normal life, but it's something that people always seem to be interested in is how you process that. You know, I think a lot of police officers and a lot of detectives are, you know, hopefully only to have to deal with one case like that in their career. But yeah. When we were with the dive team, we did, you know, that over and over and over again. And it was, you know, it was just a horrific type of thing. But at the same time, it was a very satisfying endeavor to, you know, go in there and not only help the case agents and help the detectives bring a resolution to that case, but also to deliver that victim back to their families so that they can move on. And, you know, we often hear of the debate on, as a parent, would somebody rather not know what happened to their child and just live the rest of their lives not knowing, or would they rather know? And so I, not being a parent myself, I can't really voice an opinion on that, but it is something, you know, that came up a lot in the course of this type of work. And I'm sure something that both of you have experienced yourselves.
Yeah, I think the biggest issue that you just raised was the not knowing. And it's unfortunate, but the human brain always goes to the worst possible scenario when you don't know. And so I do think psychologically it is better to know what happened. And it's horrible to have to help in these cases and unfortunately have some very negative outcomes. But the fact is that giving that information to the parents or the surviving family members or the loved ones sometimes is the only thing they can hold on to.
Yeah. And, you know, Bobby, it's interesting when you talk about some of the horrible things that you've seen. And I know Jim and I have. And I think we develop this sort of a shell or a tolerance, you know, where you just sort of incorporate it into your life. As you said, I was at a training. I've been gone from the Department of Justice for about 5 years. And I was at a training just a few weeks ago speaking at an event. And one of the classes that I attended myself was a former detective who was talking about child abuse injuries and how sometimes it's hard to see child abuse injuries on an infant because they're so malleable and flexible. And he had a video of a nanny cam that someone had put up because they suspected this man was injuring their probably, I don't know, 9 or 12-month-old child. It was hard to say exactly. And he warned us that it was a graphic video, but I was still unprepared. Because while I feel like I've seen the most horrific things that you can imagine and probably can't imagine, especially with respect to images of children being sexually abused, I made it about 45 seconds into the video of what was a horrific beating of a tiny infant, and I had to leave the room. That has never happened to me. I've spent my career looking at things just like that and worse. And somehow, because I've been gone for a few years, that tolerance or that acceptance or that ability to kind of take it in and just deal with it is gone because it wasn't my case. I didn't have to deal with it and I couldn't deal with it. And I literally had to leave the room in tears and people were staring at me. And I, you know, I like to think I'm pretty tough, but yeah, I don't know how I did what I did when I think back on it now.
Well, I think hopefully our minds go back to a default state that we try to push that horror out of our, out of the top level of our consciousness and kind of, you couldn't, I don't know that I could live in a world where that kind of horror was always at the top of, you know, at the surface. And so I think what you experienced is that you've been away from it for a little while and your mind compartmentalizes it and pushes it away so that you can live a normal, somewhat happy life. I mean, to live with that stuff day in and day out. You know, at some point, the Bureau, the FBI talked about, you know, the psychological issues that could arise in dealing with that kind of, those kind of images and those kind of horrific crimes.
Yeah, it's difficult. But all of our cases, I think, were difficult. And speaking of difficult, let's talk about a case that I'm sure you're prepared to talk about today, Bobby. My first question to you is, as always, where were you in your career when the case you want to talk about came in?
So I was leading the dive team in Los Angeles sometime, I want to say, in 2006. It was August of 2006. And I got a call from my program manager in Quantico, Virginia. And I was driving down the 405 freeway in Los Angeles on a Friday and got a call and was told that we had this kind of mission in Iraq, that they needed the senior divers of each of the four FBI dive teams to band together because this was going to be a particularly tough mission. The diving wasn't going to be as tough as some of our diving was, but just to get on scene was going to be very, very difficult.
So, Bobby, you mentioned that the four dive teams that the FBI has that ever happened before, that you got a call saying they wanted to put the lead divers on from all the teams together to do a particular mission?
No, never. And, you know, normally it was one dive team would handle a job. If they needed some backfill on divers or personnel, they'd lend from a second team or something. But this was the first time ever that I got a call like this. And, you know, like I said, it wasn't so much that they wanted people with dive experience, but they wanted people with some experience in a theater of combat or SWAT members or something like that. I had actually been to Iraq back in 2005, the year before, on a training mission. So I knew what to expect on the ground there a little bit and stuff. So they were looking for people who had that kind of experience, senior people that could go into this environment and do the work. Again, the diving they didn't think was going to be that difficult, but you know, simply getting there and surviving there was going to be the tough part.
Well, that's because it was the middle of a war. And I imagine that where this dive was going to take place was a very risky, dangerous environment.
That certainly is correct. I mean, it was out just outside a village called Yusufiya, which was part of a three-village kind of triangle that they called the Triangle of Death at that point in 2006, early on in the war, because we had lost more U.S. soldiers in that particular triangle than anywhere else in the country. There were very high-level negotiations between the Department of Defense, really the Secretary of Defense, and the FBI director about getting 12 FBI divers on the ground in this place to help the Department of Defense with this case.
Well, and Bobby, our last guest on our last podcast was retired Navy SEAL Ed Heiner, and he was talking about having been sent to Iraq, to Ramadi specifically, which I think is in the Triangle of Death somewhere. It's near there. It's one of the bloodiest, a site of one of the bloodiest battles, or many of the bloodiest battles of the Iraq War, at around the time when Marcus Luttrell, the lone survivor, had just experienced that operation and they just lost all those SEALs. I think that was right around the same time frame you're talking about.
Yeah, it may have been. I mean, I have to tell you that, you know, once I got this phone call, I was very, you know, I got tunnel vision. I just started concentrating on this case, not trying to worry about all the other things that I couldn't control. You know, and that those negotiations took place over a couple of tense hours over a 2-day period. And once that FBI headquarters was satisfied with that, then we got the go ahead and we were all summoned to Quantico.
Well, what were you told before you went to Quantico? What, if anything, were you told about why you were going to Iraq in the first place?
Well, we were told that we'd be fully briefed in Quantico, because there were certain things that they couldn't tell us or didn't want to tell us over even secured lines in the field. But they told us it involved, you know, U.S. soldiers. So we thought that U.S. soldiers either may be victims or possibly the suspects in the case. And that is what we found out when we got to Quantico the next day. We were briefed that this was a case that was being worked by the FBI's Louisville field office and the Army's CID, which is their Criminal Investigative Division within the U.S. Army. They have civilian investigators. They mainly a internal affairs type of body that look at misconduct within the service.
Well, and you had to know that this was something unusual, terrible, or huge, because DOD has plenty of investigators for all its branches of service that can investigate crimes by the military. So you had to be really wondering what this could have been about.
Yeah, it was certainly difficult. And when we got to Quantico, we got into a secure video teleconference with both the Pentagon and actually the CID investigators on the ground in Baghdad that were handling the case. They didn't need investigators per se. They needed divers. And they felt that they wanted divers from outside the Pentagon, outside the U.S. military, because the subjects in the case were 5 U.S. soldiers. And they wanted to try as much as possible not to compromise the ongoing investigation. The military is you know, a big family, and you know, you don't know who knows who and stuff. In fact, they brought our force protection unit from outside the Iraqi theater of operations, a unit that hadn't been there in a year, and they brought them in to protect us again, so they wouldn't bump into people they knew, or you know, there wouldn't be overlap. And because that we didn't know who knew what in this investigation, whenever you're dealing with an internal type investigation, you know, you have to be very, very, very careful about who knows what you're doing, because just the world is a small place sometimes, and you know, the wrong person can find out, and they didn't want that to happen. In this case, when CID briefed us, they let us know that 2 of the subjects had already been discharged dishonorably from the Army, and so they were going to be in the jurisdiction of the FBI, and particularly the Louisville field office, because they were discharged from Fort Campbell, Kentucky, and that's where they were still living off base, and so they were subjects that the Louisville field office of the FBI was prosecuting.
Well, let's back up for a second. You said you were going to have a force protection unit from outside the Iraqi theater. Can you explain to our listeners what a force protection unit is and why you needed one?
Sure. So we were the force to go in and do our job. And then force protection is the protection unit that's assigned to protect the forces that are doing another job. In other words, it's not a direct combat unit. So we were there to do the dive, and they were there to encircle us and make sure that we weren't going to be attacked by forces, opposing forces from outside of our circle. So we could concentrate and focus on the diving and the job that we had at hand, basically a crime scene. And the force protection was protecting us from threats from the outside.
Was it just threats from the outside, or were you worried about friendly fire as well?
Sure. And that's one of the reasons why we were there, and we were definitely worried about friendly fire. We went in wearing the traditional, what was at the time, the standard uniform, the military uniform, but we had no unit designations and no rank designations. So the first night we landed in Baghdad, and we had dinner in the chow hall there, it was a little tense because, you know, the military is very observant of, you know, everyone's looking, you know, in their peripheral vision about who you are, what unit you're with, what rank you are. And we didn't have anything on us that indicated any of that. So there were some long looks at us. We only spent one night in Baghdad, but there were some long looks at us at the chow hall that night because everybody's like, who are these guys? Where are they from? You know, what are they doing here? We weren't as groomed according to military standards. So they realized we had a relaxed grooming standard exemption. So that it piqued their interest even more. But like I said, we were there one night before we were put onto a secure side of Camp Liberty there in Baghdad.
Hey, you guys, when you think of the perfect gift this holiday season, you probably don't think of an electric toothbrush. But the Quip electric toothbrush is one of the most gift-guided gifts of the season, and here's why. It's perfect for everyone who has a mouth, and it's something they'll use twice a day and probably think of you while they use it. Quip also makes holiday travels clean and easy. With a multi-use cover that mounts to mirrors and unmounts to slide over the bristles, it doesn't require a clunky charger, and it runs for 3 months on one charge. I love how easy it is to travel with, how sleek, how light, how it fits in my makeup bag. And in hotel rooms, I feel like I have that extra protection by having that brush head cover. Quip is one of the first electric toothbrushes accepted by the American Dental Association and has thousands of verified 5-star reviews. I think Quip is the perfect gift and the perfect stocking stuffer. Quip looks like a big ticket tech gift too, with a stocking stuffer price starting at just $25. And if you go to getquip.com/bestcase right now, you get your first refill pack for free with a Quip electric toothbrush. But you don't have to tell your giftee that. You can keep it for yourself. That's your first refill pack free at getquip.com/bestcase.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, what's your secret? Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
So what exactly did you find out about this investigation and the dive work that you were going to have to do?
So we were told that in March or April of that year, outside of a checkpoint on the border of the village of Yusufiya, an attack had taken place on a family in that village, and that a 14-year-old girl had been raped and murdered. Her 5-year-old sister had been shot dead, and her mother and father also were shot dead, and all 4 bodies were piled together and set on fire. So they set the little house that they were living in on fire. Thereafter, the U.S. soldiers at that checkpoint rolled out and did an investigation, very cursory investigation, and it was deemed a insurgent attack, which didn't ring true to some people, but that's what it was chalked up as initially. That group, that company of soldiers, about 3 weeks after that incident, were rotated back to Fort Campbell, Kentucky, and a new company of soldiers were rotated in to man the checkpoints. These are soldiers that are way out in the middle of Iraq, in the middle of the desert, and they're manning checkpoints and they're doing village patrols with very little supervision. So it was a tense area for these soldiers to be working and patrolling. There was a lot of IEDs, a lot of insurgent activity, snipers, and just brutal attacks on our forces. So it was a very tense area. What we learned was it took the people of that village a couple of weeks, but they realized that the attack actually probably happened from the U.S. soldiers. It was an attack that was perpetrated by the U.S. soldiers from that checkpoint. In retaliation for that, they staged a car accident that the soldiers would respond to. The three soldiers responded. All three were killed in retaliation for that. That incident, that retaliation incident, it kind of rippled back to Fort Campbell, Kentucky, where the soldiers who actually perpetrated the original crime were now stationed. One of those five soldiers who didn't take part in the attack but was standing outside the house was told, come along. He really didn't know what they were planning, but he was a young kid, and he was forced into this position where he was told to come along, stand outside this house, and, you know, tell us if anybody's coming. That kid had a lot of guilt, is my take on it. And when he heard these other three soldiers were killed in retaliation, knowing those soldiers had nothing to do with the attack, probably maybe soldiers he knew from being stationed at the same Fort Campbell, he went to his pastor, it was my understanding, and he told his pastor what had happened. And the pastor told him he needed to go to his commanding officer, which he did. And that's what got the Army CID involved, the Army investigators involved. And then they started looking at these five soldiers. And then the investigation came into the FBI's radar because the Army contacted them and said, we have these two discharged soldiers still living in that area. And so the FBI got involved, started working it jointly. And that's what we were told, that we were going to go. And the way the crime was perpetrated was when they went into the house, they forced the mother, the father, and the five-year-old daughter into the bedroom. It was a one-bedroom house, and they started the attack on the 14-year-old in the outer room. At some point, the father couldn't take hearing his daughter screaming and picked up his AK-47. He was then shot by the soldier in the bedroom that was guarding him with a U.S. Army-issued shotgun. That soldier then picked up the father's AK-47 and shot the mother and the five-year-old girl dead, and then went out into the outer room, took one of his buddies off of the 14-year-old, and he then attacked the 14-year-old, and then he killed her. And then they set the whole house on fire.
Talk about depraved people. Oh, my God. I mean, it's not just that he, you know, things got out of control and he killed people in the moment. He then went and raped this 14-year-old and then killed her. It's just, it boggles the mind.
After having just shot her five-year-old sister.
Right. And how old was this guy?
In his early 20s. Specialist Green was his name.
But Bobby, the information that you guys were given, at least at that point, was that you've got a group of five soldiers all with each other and along for the ride, but one of whom is clearly the ringleader and is doing the killing and the raping. Were any of the other four soldiers, according to what you knew before you got there, involved in the physical crime or just the cover-up?
So four of the soldiers went into the house. One stood outside. Of the four that went in the house, from what I understood, at least three, if not all four, took part in the rape and the attack.
Jeez, Jim, this has got to be one of the worst things I've ever heard.
So they piled them up and they burned down the house. I don't understand why you need a dive team.
And ironically, it was those soldiers from that checkpoint who were then assigned to do the investigation the next day of this incident. And they, of course,
The perpetrators? Yes. The perpetrators were assigned the investigation.
Yeah, because they were the only ones out at this outpost. And they did that false report that it was, looked like insurgents. Of course, it was an insurgent. The townspeople knew it was an insurgent. This is not the type of attack the insurgents would ever do. And so, but it bought them enough time, because they only had 3 weeks or 2 weeks left in their rotation. It bought them enough time to get out of the country again.
And have their comrades, their buddies, their fellow soldiers set up and murdered.
Murdered us in retaliation.
They paid for those guys' crime. I mean, literally.
Right. So the reason we were called in was that we were told that the father's AK-47 was brought back to the checkpoint. Almost, I don't know if it was like a trophy or souvenir or what, but then they thought better of it. The checkpoint was on a bridge over a small river, and they threw the father's AK-47 into the river. And we were called in to dive in that river and try to locate that AK-47. You know, I don't know if it was, and Francie as a prosecutor, both Jim as a prosecutor, you know, you always try to corroborate your informant's testimony as much as possible, I guess. So that's why we were there. They had very strong testimony from one of the people involved, and I'm sure they were working on getting the cooperation of some of the other four as well. But we went over to try to locate the AK-47. So when we got on the ground in Baghdad, we were, you know, everything was really hush-hush with this whole operation. You know, to the point where I remember the night before I left for Quantico, I took my wife out to dinner to her favorite restaurant and basically told her that I was leaving the next day, couldn't tell her where I was going, couldn't tell her when I'd be back, and couldn't tell her what I'd be doing. But
I tell you, as a wife, that would have driven me absolutely nuts.
But then she sees me packing up my desert kit, which I had used the year before in Iraq, and, you know, she could put two and two together. And so we went, and we had to be inserted at night by Black Hawk helicopter because the area was too dangerous for U.S. Aircraft to be operating in the daylight. So we were dropped off by a Black Hawk helicopter in the middle of the night, and we would have to basically hike our way over to the checkpoint, and we would dive during the day, and then we would be told to just hold tight at the checkpoint, and when they were ready to pick us up, they'd give us about 5 minutes notice. We'd have to run to a designated landing zone, and the Black Hawk would pick us up in the middle of the night again.
Wow.
But not being told exactly what time, operational security reasons, those things are held very close to the vest until the last minute.
Wow.
Well, Bobby, that has to be, Jim. I mean, certainly no case I think I ever prosecuted had evidence collection conditions like Bobby talks about. I'm sure military prosecutors deal with it. But Bobby, to your point earlier about evidence and what's in corroborating evidence, it's so true that when you have a co-defendant come in and cooperate, it's critical to corroborate that co-defendant because, of course, the first one in the door generally gets more favorable plea treatment, maybe a lesser sentence, or even dismissed charges altogether. And then that makes that co-defendant the target for every other co-defendant who's going to say, well, of course, he says he didn't do it, but really, he did it. I didn't do it. And they're all pointing the finger at each other. And so you have to have that corroboration. So I can see why the father's AK-47, which is presumably going to have the father's prints and at least one of the soldier's prints on it, would corroborate a young man's account.
Yeah, unfortunately, the diving conditions were extremely difficult in that from the perspective of it was 130 plus degrees Fahrenheit in the desert while we were diving. This was August of 2006. We were diving in dry suits because the water was contaminated because it was a lot of runoff from the local farms. So you had a lot of animal waste in the water and things like that. So we had to
What's a dry suit, Bobby? Describe that.
A dry suit is a completely encapsulated vulcanized rubber suit, unlike normal dive suits, which are neoprene, which allow the water to kind of seep in and keep you cool or breathe a little bit. A dry suit doesn't allow any breathing. It doesn't allow any exchange between the water and the person. It's called a dry suit because you can spend, you know, an hour in the water, 2 hours in the water, and come out and be completely dry underneath. That's good from a barrier standpoint. It's bad from a thermal standpoint because without any air movement through that suit, you're in there baking. You're in like a sealed cellophane bag at 130 degree temperatures.
Oh my God, that's such a nightmare.
It made that part of the dive was difficult. And then, of course, you had zero visibility. This was a very muddy kind of farm type river. And to make it worse, the bridge that the checkpoint was on both sides was lined with barrels of concertina wire, which is razor wire. It comes in those 50-gallon drums. They knock it on the side. They take off the cover. And then they just unspool all this razor wire. And over the course of, you know, the years that checkpoint was there, those things were blown up and they fell into the river over and over and over again. So there were just these bales and bales of the razor wire under the water. So imagine this nest that probably is about 10 or 15 feet high of nothing but razor wire. You've seen fishing line all spool up like that, but now we're dealing with razor wire. So all of the divers that were going in were cutting their suits up. They were getting contaminated inside. So it was really difficult. So we at one point tried to have a Humvee hook some of this stuff and drag it out, but it was just too, there was too much of it and it was too entangled and they couldn't even pull it out. So, you know, we did the best we could. We got a bunch of things down there. There were guns down there. But every 2 or 3 hours, because of the heat, because of the conditions, we were getting IV fluids to keep going from our medics because we were getting dehydrated so quickly. We couldn't intake enough fluids to maintain that equilibrium of hydration. And so we were getting dehydrated quickly. We were getting IV fluids to keep going. And we worked, you know, all day in that heat. And while we found some of the stuff, we never actually located the father's AK-47.
Oh, geez.
Wow. Bobby, how would you compare that dive? You've talked to us about a couple of other cases that involved dives. One was the Israel Keyes case, where it was in Alaska under ice. You had to cut through ice to get in. And the other was a lake environment where it had been a flooded, like a forest. So it was really dangerous with respect to lines getting trapped and boats and other things being sunk down there. And this sounds terrible from a temperature and a debris and a visibility. How would you compare those three?
Well, I would say that, you know, this is an example that every dive environment has its own inherent dangers and they have to be managed. You can never, you know, bring it to zero, but you try to minimize and mitigate the risks to your divers. And so that was a large part of our job beforehand, was training and equipping ourselves to mitigate any of those dangers and do our job underwater as best we could. But diving under ice is always risky because you don't have a straight ascent to the surface. You have a hole that you have to hit. If you lose that hole where that hole is in the ice, you're going to be down there for a while. This had the razor wire cutting us up. The underwater forest often are an entanglement hazard. You can't free yourself from the entanglement. So each one of these environments brings with it its own risk and its own hazards and stuff. And, you know, the successful teams are the ones that plan for it in your dive plan and stuff. And so it's really all about preparation and mitigating, you know, the level of risk in each environment.
So in this particular case, you guys didn't find the father's AK-47. So what happened next?
So we really wanted to go back a second day. And we told them that we had probably gotten, you know, 75 to 80% into where we needed to be certain that we would get it. And it was just a call that was made by people higher than us that it was too dangerous to go back a second day because they had heard rumors through their sources that, you know, they knew, somebody knew we were there, be it insurgents or some opposing force, and that they would probably try to come after us if we had shown up a second day in the same place. It's just something the military tries never to do, never be predictable in a theater of war like that. And if we had shown up a second day, it would have been predictable. And so the decision was made. It was too dangerous to send us in for a second day. And so we left it at that.
Wow.
And did you have to do what you said earlier? Did you get, you know, 5-minute call and you had to basically run for the helicopter?
Yeah, all of our gear was put on Humvees and caravaned out on the ground. But all of our personnel, we basically, as soon as the sun went down, we went back into the checkpoint. And it was an interesting dynamic, us sitting there on one side, leaning against our bags, and on the other side of the small little walled compound were all these young 19, 20-year-old sergeant privates and specialists, you know, that were similar to the kids that we had heard in this crime. And they were very suspicious of us. Their lieutenant had come down from Baghdad just to be there for this so that, you know, there wouldn't be any problems, I guess. It was just a very unique experience and very different feeling. After a while, we were there many hours and, you know, they cooked for us. And I think they all knew kind of why we were there and were probably supportive of us. But again, they told us, you're going to have 10 minutes notice. So we were back in the checkpoint compound and we had eaten dinner and we were waiting for the call. And we got the call around 1 a.m. That the helicopters were on their way. The Blackhawks were picking us up. They sent us to an LZ. We had an Army guide, a scout in front of us and behind us. And then we heard some murmuring on the radios that were basically squatting in a pitch black field in the middle of nowhere with no cover. We have our M4s and we have some, you know, firepower, but, you know, they could, you know, we're ready for fire to come out of the darkness. And we got murmured that they changed the LZ at the last minute. Why? I don't know. But then we had to hump a couple of hundred yards to an adjacent field and they picked us up there. Maybe there was a threat on that first field. Maybe they change it just to change it at the last minute for security reasons. But then they picked us up about 1:30 a.m. And we were out of there. We spent a very, very long day, a long, hot day, you know, in the middle of a war zone processing a crime scene.
Yeah. Well, Bobby, I just have one question. Did they ask this young soldier, this one that felt guilty and told his pastor about it, did they ever ask him why these guys did what they did?
Well, I'm sure they asked him. I don't know what his answer was, but I can tell you that Brian De Palma, the noted filmmaker, made a movie about this case. It's called Redacted. It was very limited release in 2008. It tells the story of this attack. It doesn't tell our role in it because he didn't know about our role in it. But it ends, I believe, at the attack or at when they got rotated out. But it shows these soldiers planning it, and it shows them. So I assume that the movie was made based on some transcripts that they had gotten from some of the court proceedings, because there's a lot of detail in that movie, Redacted, about this attack. It shows all five soldiers. It shows how it happened. And it's a, you know, it's a pretty dark film, but if anybody wanted to know about this, it's there. Specialist Green, the ringleader of the crew, was sentenced, I believe, to the death penalty. And several years ago, he hung himself in prison. He committed suicide. Mm.
So that answers my question on that, Bobby. At least one of them paid a price for their horrific, evil conduct. What about the others? Do you know?
I believe there were one or two death penalties, one or two life in prisons with now possibility of parole. And the guy that was outside, the guy that cooperated, may have gotten less.
Did you ever learn what their backgrounds were, these guys that decided to do this? Had they ever been arrested? Were they in gangs? Were they just grew up bad? What happened?
You know, I was told unofficially that they were, you know, the four of them were inside the house, were four young, very young kids, a couple from the Midwest that were down there in the place where they were. I think a lot of their officers were, you know, spending more time up in the green zone. And they were left on to their own devices, and things like this tend to happen in a war zone. We've seen it in other wars, certainly.
But we've seen it on both sorry, points. Bobby. Maybe we've seen something like this, but this is, I just can't accept that things like this happen in a war. It's terrible. It's obviously, I think, behaviorally part of the dehumanization of the enemy. But these people weren't even the enemy. They were just civilians. And it just makes, you know, it makes my blood boil that these guys, these U.S. soldiers would do such horrific things to everyday people and little girls. And, you know, it's just the heroism of the father.
Yeah. No, I in no way mean to excuse it when I say this happens in every war. I simply say that because years ago I saw a film with Michael J. Fox and Sean Penn, and it was about the Vietnam War. And a unit of U.S. soldiers who basically kidnapped a Vietnamese young girl and took her along on their patrol and abused her and attacked her repeatedly. So, you know, it was almost eerily familiar to this. This was a different type of situation, but the brutality and the I don't know what you would even call it, the horrific way of behaving. And this animalistic, it's just animals don't even do this. It's just, it stays with you. And I don't, you know, it's a case that I don't like to think about often because you get angry and you get, it's one of those cases though, that in my career that I'll always think about and always wish, you know, hadn't happened. Right. And I'm glad for our involvement in it, but you know.
Yeah. Well, Bobby, I think that your last statement probably sums it up, but we have to ask. Is this a best case or a worst case? And why?
This is a worst case because it's hard not to think about it. When I see people talk about their experiences in Iraq, and I had a very good experience in 2005 in Iraq when I went and trained the Iraqi police officers and some military people on investigations and stuff. But my war experience and you know, there was a time where I was flying back from a third trip over to the Middle East on something, and I was flying back with some soldiers that were in, you know, in the gate area in Germany, and where I was, and you know, there was a lot of applause for the soldiers, and I applaud the soldiers and the military as much as anybody. But you know, I feel bad because it almost taints my not my opinion. I'm a very big supporter of the U.S. military, But it's always, I always have that in the back of my mind that, you know, there are bad people everywhere. You know, you can't say that, you know, these bad people that are out there doing bad things are confined to any profession, right, any demographic, any race, creed, religion, or color. It doesn't kind of zap your faith, but it does kind of, you know, it's one of those things that stays with you.
Yeah.
Well, and Bobby, that you, like you said earlier, this happens in war. It's not an excuse for it, but look at the massacre at My Lai in Vietnam. Look at UN soldiers, UN peacekeepers, who are in war-torn countries supposed to protect the civilians. Instead, they're raping children and young women. It seems to me that when you hand someone ultimate power, some people are going to take advantage of that in evil ways. I mean, I just think it's one of those mysteries of human behavior that maybe someone like Jim understands. I certainly don't. I never will. And I find it, like you, horrifyingly difficult to understand.
Well, the only thing I can say, Francie, is that the fact of the group of it, the mob mentality of it, what we see in the behavioral analysis unit is that when people get together and they kind of work each other up into this frenzy, they can dehumanize people to an extent that individuals don't. They're then capable, because they have the support of their friends, they can be capable of doing something incredibly more horrific than they would do as an individual. And I think this is an example of that. I don't understand it. I hate it. I, you know, despise the fact that these poor people had to suffer that. And I, you know, commend you, Bobby, for going out and doing your professional best to help that family. I just remain disgusted by the behavior.
These are the kind of cases that stay with us, you know, and I know divers that were on that mission with me, and I still speak to some of them today. And it's something that we don't talk about, but we all know that none of us have ever forgotten it.
Yeah.
No, these things imprint, I think, on us in ways that we don't understand at the time, or maybe even now. But Bobby, thank you so much for agreeing to come on and be our 100th episode guest. And on a lighter note again, Jim, it's so great be back interviewing with you again. People have been asking on Facebook and Twitter, where's Jim Francie? I think some of them have worried I've murdered you.
Well, Francie, I'm sure you've come close, at least in your mind. But thank you, Bobby, and thank you, Francie. It's been an incredible 100 episode journey, and can't wait to have you back on for episode 200 and 300.
It's been an honor. It was an honor to be your first guest, and it's even more of an honor now to see the success of this podcast and to be on your 100th episode. So thank you for having me.
All right, well, take care. And for now, signing off till next time for Best Case, Worst Case.
Best Case, Worst Case is an XG production. Produced by Jim Clementi at Empire Studios, LA. Engineered and edited by Mike Thal. Music composed and performed by Simba Sumba and hosted by Wonder.
You can listen to Best Case, Worst Case on your favorite listening app. We are on Spotify, Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, and wherever you listen to podcasts.
Stories about child sexual abuse can make us feel powerless. But the good news is that there are organizations working to prevent abuse and keep kids safe. Darkness to Light and their Stewards of Children prevention training has trained more than 1.4 million adults to protect, recognize, and react responsibly to child sexual abuse.
But there's more work to do, and with their 4 million by 2020 goal, Darkness to Light is setting their sights on training 4 million adults around the country to keep kids safe. By donating to Darkness to Light, you can help reach this goal that will make communities across the country safer places for kids.
It starts with you. Visit www.d2l.org today to give. That's www.d2l.org.